State of opportunity.
State of opportunity.
I want to be a firefighter.
A ballerina.
I want to be a Batman.
This is a State of Opportunity documentary from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Today, Connections, the Power of Networks, Part 3. If you're just joining us, the last two podcasts we've been talking about networks, specifically folks who lack networks and what that means for their futures. If you don't have a network, it can be very difficult to advance socially or in your career. One nonprofit leader I spoke to called it a crisis of relationships. That's exactly the kind of crisis DeAndre Austin faced 5 years ago.
As far as finding a legal job and a guaranteed paycheck job, it was hard. But as far as finding anything else that's bad in the world, the network can find a lot of bad things, you know.
That is the beauty and the beast, if you will, of networks. If your network is diverse with upwardly mobile people, people who have resources and can help you out, you're probably going to do okay. But if your network is largely homogenous, filled with people struggling just like you, you're in trouble. As DeAndre tells it, his mom had a hard time providing for herself, DeAndre, and his two brothers. So when DeAndre was 17, he struck out on his own and relied on his network to help him find a place to live. But the only people in his network were homeless teens and drug dealers. So those are the people who stepped in to help.
And basically, I lived in a foreclosure crib at one point in time. So no lights, no electricity. You got to heat up hot water to clean yourself, and you know, so.
Did you have to do anything not quite legal to make money?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I definitely didn't do the right, I wasn't on the right path making the money. But I was making the money, but I wasn't doing the right things to get it, no.
DeAndre says he sold drugs and had people steal things for him. But he also says he tried to get a job. He says he called tons of places, fast food joints, big box stores, you name it, he applied. But nobody would hire him. Until one day, he got a call.
Come on down to the back of the warehouse.
2 years ago, DeAndre hooked up with a nonprofit in Ypsilanti for homeless youth. Through that group, he heard about Food Gatherers. He did a job training program at Food Gatherers, and when a job opened up, he applied and got it.
Well, I'm the warehouse facility assistant. We got the pantry freezer over there. We got two big, great produce pallets that I put out every single morning.
Here he is, working at a food bank that helps feed people who are homeless. He used to be one of those people. The irony is not lost on him. But he knows if he finds himself in trouble now, without a place to sleep or something to eat, he has got people in his network that can help him out.
I think I got a little bit more people than I had. Way more people than I had, actually, but because I had none. But I think I got like at least two or three people I can call.
Where do you think you would be if, you know, you hadn't done the work zone and hadn't gotten into Food Gatherers? And
who knows? Basically, I'm pretty sure I'd be in the wrong field this job haven't hired me. I'm pretty sure I'd be like dead or in jail or prison, you know.
I'm Jennifer Guerra. This is Connections, the Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. So what happens to people who do wind up in prison? From what I've been told, it's lonely and isolating. You're totally separated from the life and the world you knew before you went in. How do you create connections in a place like that? Well, for some prisoners, connection starts with people on the outside, specifically college students from the University of Michigan.
We're going to dance and do ridiculous things, and like we're all going to do it together, and that's why it's not going to be embarrassing. So what's going
to
happen is
welcome to the first night of a theater workshop at Cooper Street Prison in Jackson. University of Michigan senior Paris LaRocque leads about a dozen men, most in their 20s and 30s, in the first of four improv games they'll play this hour.
All right, Sheldon. Hey, Sheldon!
What?
Show us how you get down.
No way.
Show us how you get down.
Okay. D. O. W.
Now, aside from their blue and orange prison uniforms, you quickly forget that we're in a prison. There's dancing and laughter and what looks like real joy on the guys' faces. The class is part of the U of M's Prison Creative Arts Project, or PCAP. It's been around for 25 years. Here's how it works. Professors and students from U of M travel to prisons all over Southeast Michigan, leading inmates in theater workshops, writing and painting workshops. The classes last a whole semester, and at the end, the inmates put on a show of some kind for their fellow prisoners.
We'd have improv, and we would play freeze, and we learned some of the real basic theater skills that I still really enjoy to this day.
This woman, Mary, was one of the first prisoners ever to act in a PCAP play. She was released from prison over a decade ago, but she asked that we not use her last name because she doesn't want to suffer from employment discrimination in the future. Mary entered prison when she was 21, and like a lot of 21-year-olds, perhaps even more so, she had a lot of stuff going on in her head that she needed to work through, things like grief, sickness, life in general. But she had no real friends on the inside to talk to. And so the U of M students and teachers who came in weekly to teach the theater workshop, they became her friends, her network.
There was plenty of times when PCAP really kept me going because it's hard to be snowed in a facility in the dead of winter and not have any connection to the outside world. So to have somebody with that level of commitment that's really working with you and you can really feel changes in yourself, that's extremely important to people's survival and certainly to mine.
Mary was in prison for over 2 decades, and by the time she was released, her parents had moved to a new city. So she was paroled near them, far from where she had grown up and everything she had once known.
I had no community to come home to. I had my beautiful family, who I loved dearly, but my parents were elderly. My brothers and sisters were grown and gone. I was literally starting over with what I came home with.
All she had was a red 3-piece knit suit she had saved up to buy and a pair of black heels. She says the only thing the prison gave her when she walked out the door was $5 and 3 condoms.
That's what they thought I needed for reentry.
Her only saving grace, she says, was the network she had formed with PCAP.
There's so much you don't know about being free when you haven't been free for a very long time. And just the reorientation and the ability to be in a community of friends, of people that really like you and respect you and honor your work, that's tremendous.
Ever since her release from prison, Mary has done just about everything she can with PCAP. She's been a guest speaker. She's mentored ex-felons returning home. She's even helped curate some of the art shows. And now she works for PCAP. She co-teaches one of U of M's prison workshops. She used PCAP as a launching pad for her new life on the outside, a life she had waited some 20 years to begin. Now, Mary left prison in the early 2000s. Back then, Michigan did not have any kind of formalized program to help ex-felons reenter society. Mary and thousands of other ex-felons were completely on their own when it came to rebuilding their networks and community. Today, things are better. In 2005, the state launched its Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative. The goal? To help the thousands of inmates paroled every year learn some kind of marketable skill, find a job, and stay out of prison. That is how Calvin Evans wound up here, as the guy in charge of hiring and firing people at a frame-making company in Ann Arbor called Urban Ashes. He got the job through a parolee re-entry program in Brighton that trains and hires the chronically underemployed. At the time, he was doing a job where he had to sort engine brackets. One day, a supervisor came over and said,
"We need help over in the Urban Ashes department. Do you know anything about wood?" And I was like, "Know how to use a tape measure." So he actually asked me, "How many 16ths is in an eighth?" And so because of my experience and, you know, my criminal activity, I knew.
Let's pause here and talk a little bit about Calvin Evans' criminal activity, the reason he wound up in prison for 24 years. The way Evans tells it, his family lived in poverty and his mom was in an abusive relationship. So she sent Calvin and his brothers to live with their grandmother in Detroit.
My grandmother, she used to work for General Motors, and I used to see her coming home, and she had this soot all over her, and she used to cough it up.
His grandmother used to work on the line at General Motors.
I'm seeing all this, like, hardworking people, but we were still poor. but I didn't know how to solve this problem.
The only people he saw making good money around him were the drug dealers in his neighborhood. This was back in the 1980s when crack cocaine was running rampant through the city.
So I began to hang around them in their cars, you know, and they'd take me shopping. So they're kind of like courting me, if you will. They're petitioning me to be a part of this drug world, and I'm fascinated with this whole thing, and so.
He liked the lifestyle they could offer. He was sick of being poor. He figured dealing drugs was an easy way to make money. Plus, he told himself and his mom that he was doing it for the family. He'd sell drugs so his little brothers wouldn't have to. So there he is one night in Mount Clemens with a bunch of other guys doing a drug deal when things go wrong, horribly wrong. Shots start flying, and one guy was shot and killed. Evans still swears he did not do it, but he was convicted of murder and served 24 years. When it was time for his parole in 2013, he had a plan. He was going to be the best ex-con he could be. He was going to fly right, go to school, get a job. Little did he realize how much he would use his drug skills to help him land a legal job at Urban Ashes. Not only was he good with math, remember.
I knew what an eighth was because I sold dope. And so, like, 2/8 is a quarter. 2/16 is an eighth. So
Evans also knew how to network. Back when he was selling drugs, he was all about networking.
The crew that I ran with, my job was to find drug houses and also people to put in the drug house to sell the drugs.
You networked.
Right.
Well, I think it's so interesting. I mean, like, you were talking about, like, your job was to find the houses and then put people in the houses and whatever. I mean, now you're a human resources manager, right? And your job is to find people and put them in this building.
Exactly.
And get them to create beautiful works of art.
Right. And then mentor them along the way.
Joking aside, that last part there, the mentoring part, that's key. That has been Calvin Evans' entire mission since he got out of prison 2.5 years ago. He wants to help ex-cons bridge the gap between life behind bars and life on the outside. And he's doing it with the help of Urban Ashes founder and president, Paul Hickman.
It's like landing on the moon. You know, they come out of prison after 20-some years. You might as well drop them on the moon. They're in a whole different society.
When designer Paul Hickman first started his framing company, Urban Ashes, he did not think his work crew would consist of a bunch of ex-felons. At first, he wasn't sure what to expect. It's human nature, he says, to question how much you can trust somebody who just spent 20 years locked up. But he says all that started to fade away once he worked alongside them in the shop, sawing and cutting and shaping the wood just so. Now he's got 6 employees, 3 of whom are ex-felons. He's trained them, he's mentored them, and he pays them a good wage. And here's what he gets in return.
I've never had a more dedicated crew, a more committed crew to making sure things are done correctly and getting things done on time. They are very proud of what they do. You've got a group of people that may be proud of something for the first time in their life, and that's pretty incredible.
Paul Hickman's business is a small one, though, and he can't just hire a lot of people. So he's now turned his attention to other small business owners, trying to convince them to hire ex-felons just like he did. And he's holding up Urban Ashes as a model. As for Calvin Evans' part, he's on the county's workforce development board to make sure ex-felons have a voice in terms of job opportunities. And he's in the process of setting up a network of folks to do peer-to-peer counseling with ex-felons upon their release. Evans has even gone back to prison, voluntarily, to recruit prisoners on their way out to come work for Urban Ashes, show them there is a way forward, and it comes with a good paycheck. He also mentors the crew he works with right now, just like he used to do back when he was selling drugs.
I'm doing the same thing here. I see one of them doing something that is hazardous to the company. I take them out to lunch. So I'm high count. And so what I do is I'm developing a personal relationship with them. And in developing this personal relationship, I can get them to see the vision of the company.
He tells them, this isn't a job. This is a career. And we want you here. More than 2 million people are behind bars in the United States. And there's a national movement to cut that number in half over the next decade. To have a network of mentors like Calvin Evans and small businesses like Urban Ashes lined up to help with resources and a paycheck, That could mean the difference for some folks between going back to prison and freedom. You've been listening to Connections, The Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. The State of Opportunity team includes Sarah Alvarez, Dustin Dwyer, and Brittany Barkowiak. Special thanks to independent producer Zach Rosen and our social media producer, Paula Friedrich. Sarah Hewlett edited today's show. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.